Welcome to this session of the 2019 Conference on World Affairs, panel number 5207, Race, Please Select One. In this session, we will utilize both the CWA app and a note card system to receive questions from the audience. To ask a question in the app, simply select the session in the schedule, tap Q&A, and then insert and send your question. And you may also raise your hand to request a note card and pencil from one of our producers. There's one upstairs and one, take them over here, downstairs. It is important that if you are using a note card that you please write legibly and sort of large so that I can see it. If you are a student or attending remotely, please note this in your question. Please make your questions brief and to the point. Our panelists today are Maya Averbuch. Nikhil Mankekar, Carolina Quiroga Stoltz. My name is Hillary Potter. I am the moderator of this panel. I am a CU alum, both bachelor's degree and PhD in sociology. I am associate professor in the Department of Ethnic Studies and associate dean for diversity, equity, and inclusive practices here in the College of, because my office is right upstairs on the second floor, in the College of Arts and Sciences. Please feel free to reach out to me on any concerns you have around issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion, not just in the College of Arts and Sciences, but about our campus in general. Again, this session is race. Please select one. People assume that each of us is either one race or another, depending on the color of our skin, how we behave, or how we interact with others. As our cultures continue to mix, what happens when we don't look the part? So each of our panelists will take 5 to 7 minutes to introduce themselves to you and to state why they are participating in this panel.
Hi, my name is Maya Averbuch. I'm a journalist currently based in Mexico City. I've spoken on several panels at this conference about immigration, about threats against journalists, about the hazards of displacement, and that's what I've been covering for the past 3 years. So this panel is a little different for me. It's a little bit more about, I suppose, my own background and how I ended up doing that work. I come from New York, but from parents who are from India and Israel. My mother immigrated from India to go and study in grad school in the US, and my father is an artist from Israel, a sculptor who ended up in the US also to try to be that, to try to be an artist and to try to be part of the art scene. And a lot of what that has meant has been growing up in a household where my parents didn't spoke to one another in English, they didn't speak the same language as one another, and so I grew up speaking only English and ended up making a huge effort to speak Spanish because that was the language available to me to learn, because otherwise the process of selecting another language of either speaking Hebrew or either speaking Hindi was an act of sort of aligning yourself and in a sort of feudal battle that takes place within the household. Declaring yourself to be part of one side or the other. And so I think that growing up in a household that's mixed race is incredibly enriching, and I spend a lot of my summers going and spending time with family, either in India or in Israel. But there is also a constant negotiation that happens in any household, but one that I think was made all the more obvious in mine because the cultural backgrounds of my parents were so different. And because they had made this obvious choice to live in New York in a place where everybody was an immigrant, and they too were immigrants, and yet from such incredibly different backgrounds, that the idea of what it is to go and spend time with someone who is an other to you and who is not sharing in many of the things that are your closest traditions, was sort of the day-to-day of growing up. And so I think that it's interesting in a time in the U.S. where we also talk very openly about race in a way that other countries don't. For example, the idea that you would go to elementary school and select what race you are, what ethnicity you are, is very foreign in a place like Mexico where I'm living now. I've explained this to people and they look at me in horror. And I tell them, well, it's supposed to be for good things, right? It's supposed to be so we have some sense of accountability, so we have a sense of, like, who is in school. And yet that sort of explicitness is, I think, complicated and fraught and tied into issues of law and into sort of declarative statements that we are expected to make about who we are and where we come from. And I think it's also been particularly interesting for me because I live in Mexico now, in part, as I explained to you, I spent a lot of time learning Spanish in the absence of being able to learn other languages. But I hope to do that later. And was very interested in what it means for people to be displaced and to either have to or opt to leave where they're from. And so spending a lot of time talking to people who are in the middle of the process of getting up and leaving where they're from, in a way as my parents did, but really their experience is very far from it. And yet at a fundamental level is connected because they are uprooting themselves and trying to find a new place to live. Was very much part of the experience of trying to understand what my own family was and why they had ended up in the U.S. And yet I also pass as Latino in Mexico, and that is something that I have to correct eventually. Usually by the fifth sentence, someone understands that I'm maybe not a native speaker, maybe not from Mexico, but I have a Mexico City accent at this point. So it's very confusing. I'm very confusing to people, and it's a sort of fraught position to be in, especially when I'm in southern Mexico, and my name is Maya, and that has a whole other tradition in Mexico. And for me, my name is Maya because that is a word that exists in both Hindi and Hebrew. It's a originally Sanskrit word that means illusion in India and has religious connotations, and in Hebrew is related to the word for water. And so, again, in the constant negotiation that you do in your household to try to figure out how to not have your child align with one culture or another too much before they can make choices for themselves, that is the name I was given. And yet I am in a context now where it means something totally different. And that has been an interesting space to be in, but also a fraught one.
Okay, I'm Nikhil Mankekal. I was just added to this panel at the last minute, so excuse me if I look down at my phone a bit at some notes. But I'm the, locally, I'm known as the chair of the city's Human Relations Commission. We advise the city council on human rights policy, so race, discrimination, policing, homelessness, immigration, all of those issues. Additionally, some of you might know me from my KGNU radio show, Poco and Boco, People of Color in Boulder County, in which we discuss issues that I imagine will come up on this panel. So my background is I'm a native of Boulder, but I'm Indian, and my father is Hindu, and my mom is Punjabi Sikh. Both of them, like Maya's family, came to the U.S. To study in graduate school, and that's how they met. And on my mom's side, it's while she's Indian, her family is multi-generational in Indonesia and Malaysia. So you have this mix of all these ethnicities and religions I grew up with, and you know, getting to travel to both of those countries. And if you know anything about Southeast Asia, it is really the place that the confluence of so many Asian cultures, from Chinese, Indian, to the Indonesian, Japanese, all of them come together around Indonesia and Malaysia. So I was raised in a household that was I guess one race, but multi-ethnic, with two different kind of home bases with the families, and different kind of immigration story. I, grew up in Boulder, but also, again, it's interesting because if I don't identify myself as Indian or Sikh, I spend a lot of my times based on what I do in meetings with for instance, a Latino community, and they might, they might assume that I don't speak Spanish, or two, they just, I'm passing as one of them. Additionally, I was involved in establishing Indigenous Peoples Day in the city, And in that, I worked closely with a lot of the indigenous tribes and continue to. And recently, we had a visit from some of the local tribes who had been pushed off of the land that the city is trying to establish a relationship with again. And it was, I sat in on these meetings, and I didn't say anything. They lasted 2 days, and I guess, like, first day, we didn't say anything. So the second day at lunch, like, a lot of them had just assumed, you know, was asking me, like, what tribe I came from, and had assumed that. So there's all these assumptions. It's interesting when I saw the subject of this topic. I think of this country in all of the ways, the challenges people can face, because, you know, after 9/11, you had Sikhs being taken for Muslims and being victims of hate crimes. And if, you know, as immigration issues come up and that dog whistle gets blown, whether it's, you know, related to a border wall in Mexico, then, you know, I'll even have, you know, people will assume that about me, and you'll have to face those issues. And so, so there's ways, you know, that outside of checking a box, it's also about how people view you, and that really dictates how they will choose to see you and interact with you, and what kind of experience you'll have with them, and in a space and in a community. Another thing that came to mind was, based on my family background, usually when we think about, you know, which box to check, if Indian, it's difficult because usually you just have, you know, Caucasian and these kind of broad labels, and they just classify all Asians as one, as if, you know, Asia is just this homogenous place with one kind of people, and of course that's not the case, you know, I mean, I don't... So if you have Chinese background, if you have Indian background, if you have Japanese background, Southeast Asian or Indonesian, you all check this box that just labels you all Asian. So in some ways, you know, it's a question of, you know, what does that do to you? How can you authentically identify your own background and experience, and also interact with people in the way you want to if you're not allowed to... even given the option of identifying what background you come from. Additionally, I'm thinking, you know, why do we... This is becoming an important question, because why do we classify so much? Like, why do we have to classify race and ethnicity so much, especially in the U.S.? It's something, I think, especially in this country, that's happening, and we have this new emphasis on, you know, technology. Everything is based on algorithms and data gathering and identifying people. And again, if you come back to that issue of making a homogenous label of, you know, Asia is just one type of race and one kind of box you check. We're saying Latino. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean second generation Mexican immigrant, first generation, and then you classify all people from South America as being under that one label? So this is going to increasingly lead to a lot of issues, I think. And also, in identifying people so much, and it can have a divisive effect. And I was thinking that, you know, who gets to decide what labels we use to identify ourselves? And there's a question on who is asking the question. And it often seems that you have one race of people tends to be in control of that. And it's, as a minority, you often experience white people wanting to know how you identify yourself. In some ways, it might even be signaling you to validate the way that they choose to identify you. And it can lead to issues such as controlling access to resources, who gets what. Again, it can be used in a divisive way. And, you know, one of the ways this came up in what I do locally is we've had issues in the past with police profiling. I guess we have them now if you've been following the news. But back in 2015, we had to do an audit of the local PD, and they looked at, you know, ticketing of black residents was happening at 5 times the rate of white people. So we wanted to investigate why this was happening and how the city could fix this issue. That was just data being collected on people being ticketed. What they found was, you know, if you look at the issue of profiling, it could be stops that, you know, don't wind up with a ticket being issued. This data was not being collected, is what we found out. And something that was interesting is that they had to implement a system, a new call-in system, in which they had to decide how do we, if we just stop people and ID check them, how do we identify them? And we felt that if the police had to ask someone in one of those situations how they identify themselves, it might potentially escalate a situation. So ultimately what they went with was, no, use the officer themselves to just decide how they choose to identify them. And call it in and check that box. So again, checking boxes to me seems messy and can lead to messy outcomes in all of the ways I described. But I look forward to speaking more as we get to Q&A. Thank you.
So my name is Carolina. I'm a storyteller, performer. I'm bilingual. And bilingual, by the way, means, in my case, English and Spanish. Because that's one of the things I realized in this country. Sometimes a lot of times they assume that if I say bilingual, that's exactly what it means. But no, bilingual means two languages. That's it. And it doesn't have to be English, doesn't have to be Spanish. All right? I just happen to do it in English and Spanish. And when I have the chances to do a story that comes from an indigenous group in Latin America, because I only tell stories from Latin America, then I would do the effort or the homework to research more about their vocabulary and try to include some of those indigenous words so people understand that even in our own Latin American universe, we not only speak Spanish, we speak other languages, Nahuatl, Quechua Aymara, Portuguese, Mapuche. There's so many others. In my work as a performer, I one day realized that I wanted to reach out to more people, and I also realized that I've been here for 7 years in the United States, and the more people that I meet, the more I realize that people don't know much about Latin America, and the few things they know is what they have learned from media, and normally media portrayed as pretty bad. Like, oh, those poor third world countries, right? Oh, we have to feel so much pity for them. And when you feel pity towards another person, you're not valuing their rich culture. You're assuming that they just don't have anything. And that's pretty sad. And so I'm trying, through my work, I launched a podcast on bilingual stories from Latin America, trying to educate people a little bit on their own culture and to others to educate them in what is that we have, who are we. And my work is only based on traditional stories. I don't do personal stories. One day perhaps I'll get there, but there's so much of personal stories these days. And I think one of the best ways to get to know another culture is through their folktales, myths, and legends, because I've been repeating this through the whole week. It's a non-threatening environment. When you get to say once upon a time, the color disappears. Yeah, you all get to be heroes. The hero all always have a bunch of ordeals and problems, and they will overcome that because that is just the human condition. We came here to go through a journey. And we have individual journeys, collective journeys. So my idea has been trying to get there. And eventually I talk about the story or where the story comes from. And I throw a little thing here, political, you know, critical thinking. You got to think about this. You've been assuming this all the time. Maybe you shouldn't think about it. And then I normally resume with another story. Because it's really hard to talk about sensitive things such as this one. Especially these days, it's very sensitive, and people get kind of afraid that you're going to be insulted because that's exactly what's going on through media. People are just insulting each other. And a word such as being biased is assumed as it's racism, when bias is just your preference on something. I prefer my dog over other dogs. Yes, I'm biased. I love my dog. I think he's the best dog in the whole entire world. Sue me. But there's a lady who wrote a book on that these days the word bias means racism. And no, it just means your preference over something. You just going to go that way. But I just, since I'm a storyteller, I wanted to share just some few tiny little anecdotes. I think I have like 2-3 minutes left. Yeah, right. Four. Oh, nice. I've been talking fast. That sounds good. So I met, when I was in Tennessee doing my master's in storytelling, I met this lady who lived upstairs, and she was from the Philippines. Now, the Philippines were colonized by the Spaniards, and they, of course, were imposed Spanish. Now, I was talking to her, and we were just getting to know each other, and she said to me that she regretted so much that she did not try to teach her children when she came to the United States Spanish, because she all her life, growing up after the Spanish left, they became this idea that anything that was Spanish or indigenous or native was backwards, it was stupid, undeveloped. No, you have to reject it, you have to learn English because that's the way to succeed. Success is in America and the United States, blah, blah, blah. And she told, when I told her that I do bilingual storytelling and that's how I'm trying to make my living, she said that she wishes so badly she had taught them Spanish to her children because now they're needing it. They are doctors, and they could do much better if they were speaking a second language. So that's one of the things that I've came across here in the United States. A lot of people, like Maya was saying, and that a lot of times people come and they are trying so hard to absorb the new culture because media is telling you too. You have to be like one of us. You have to blend in. Right? And since you can't blend in because of your color or skin, you might as well try with the culture and the language. And so they try to forget and completely where they come from. They don't share those stories anymore. They don't speak their language at home. And of course, these kids are growing up completely, there's a broken link there. I met once this girl. She, fortunately, she wasn't speaking Spanish too. But I was doing a research on how many indigenous people they knew, et cetera, and she's Mexican-American, and I asked her if she knew any indigenous people in Mexico. She has traveled up there. And she spoke about indigenous people so badly, so it was denigrating. And I was looking at her, and I thought to myself, have you looked at yourself in the mirror, lady? Because you totally look like them. So there's a broken link right there. She's expressing about those others that her mom or that her own culture left behind. She's expressing in an entirely different way, but she's not recognizing that she looks like them. Eventually, hopefully one day she'll get there. But in Latin America, that has happened. Our history tells us that we have tried so hard to whitening ourselves, our cultures. First, we were looking for 400 years. Europe was the Eurocentrism. You gotta be white. You have to whiten your skin. You gotta marry a white guy. You have to. The lighter you look, the more success, the more opportunities you have, and the more you reject that other past, that will be much better for you. You'll have more chances in life. I think that was my story.
Thank you all, and my apologies to you, Maya, for mispronouncing your last name. And I have 2 13-year-old nieces named Maya, so thank you for that story as well about your experience. And so the first question, people don't tend to confuse me and my race. They assume I'm black or African-American, which is correct. That's how I identify. But my name, that causes some issues, particularly before someone meets me and they meet me in person and they may say, Hillary Potter? Like, are you sure that's who you are? Yes, I understand my name is very British, very Anglo, but yes, that is my name. So I don't get that in the same way, but there's often this question when many people within our society, particularly here in the United States, there is this question of what are you when they see someone who is multiracial, which we're all multiracial, right? But where it's so ambiguous because we have this thing, this social thing, that we need to be able to identify someone's gender someone's race, those two in particular. And then there are others that we want to know about. What do you do for work? What class are you, socioeconomic status? So on the what are you, what type of responses, if you've gotten that question, what type of responses have you given to the what are you question, and whether you've gotten that question or not, what your responses are within the United States, within a U.S. context, or places that have a similar racial interactions as we do across the world. What advice would you give to address the connotations around asking a question like that?
Well, I mean, in my case, I've been asked that a lot. And I'm going to tell a short anecdote. I was in Tennessee, and I was with some friends, and we went to a bar, disco something, first time for me being there, and it was a drag queen show. And then I went to the bathroom, and the drag queens were there, gigantic, tall women like this. And one of them turns and says, "Girl, where do you come from?" And so I said, "I come from Colombia." And she's like, no, "What's your ethnicity?" And I'm like, I have no, first time someone asked me, "What's your ethnicity?" She was seeing way beyond the Latino there. I don't know if it was good or bad, but I've been asked similar questions. Now, most of the times people stop after Colombia. They get it right there. But I do remember that for years, and I've been telling this, that when I was growing up, my parents did a big effort trying to send me to private schools, and all private schools had a lot of mostly white people. And so, of course, I looked like this, and I'd never had many issues about it, really, until they start calling me India, which is Indian. And then the more I heard about it, I began realizing that it was a little bit of an insult, because India in Latin America is not from Indian. No, it means indigenous native people, and that is associated to backward, undeveloped, et cetera. You can just go down from there. And so I began asking myself, am I that? And I began researching, and through my research, I found these myths and legends from all these people, and I was like, yeah, I want to be like that. I really don't care about the other labels, because those other labels were given by the Spanish people for 500 years, even from religious perspective and political, economic perspectives, because they were trying to just keep these guys kind of submissive, dormant, that they would not act out, that they would forget their valuable past, that they would feel shame about themselves because they were worshiping other gods, not the true Christian God, and all that kind of stuff. So I put that aside, and I decided to embrace that India. And when I came to the United States, I did my DNA test, and it came out that I'm like almost 50% Native American from all across Native America. And I was like, yes! I earned it, you bet. And the other side, of course, comes from Spain and Persia, which kind of reinforce the color that are there. And I showed that to my dad just last time we talked. And I said, hey, Dad, did you know that we have Indios, we have indigenous people in our blood? He got so mad. And he looks a little bit darker than me. You put one of those Peruvian hats on, he totally passed as a Quechua person, totally. Well, he got so mad. He was like, no, that's not possible. That's your mom's fault. And he said, perhaps we have a little bit of black in us, but just a little bit. But we are what? And that's the discourse, the speech that most of Latin Americans give to each other. Just look at the Mexican, if you watch Mexican shows and Mexican TV shows in the morning and all that, those are all white ladies. Just recently, that movie Roma finally put an indigenous person that comes from Mexico. And most of their population is mestizo or looks like her. So, yeah, that's my story.
Yeah, I find that question of asking to identify myself, it's become, being someone who's been in Boulder a long time, it's an exhausting one because, you know, like I said in the introduction, I come from multiple backgrounds, and I could identify myself if someone asks, you know, I get asked where I'm from all the time, and I'm like, I don't know, I'm a Boulder Community Hospital baby, and there's just not many, you know, most of the white people I meet in Boulder moved to town, like, in the last decade, like, there's just not a lot of people who've been here as long as I have, and so to be asked that question by those people can sometimes feel, a little bit off-putting, and then there's some days when it's like, this is my hometown, and I'm just, like, you know, hanging out, on the downtown mall, and like everybody else. And so you get asked, well, what are you? And I know what that means is they want me to talk about being Indian, or then they want me to delve into religion and talk about being Sikh, or, you know, whatever it is that they see. And it's kind of like, I just want to be like a native Boulder today, like all of the people I grew up with. I don't want to, you know, I can always tell when someone is posing the question because they see someone different and they want to, I don't know, it's like they want to get a taste of something exotic, and it's like almost the conversation is good. I can tell they want you to educate them and give them some kind of information, like some kind of inside scoop on your ethnicity or something. So it's an interesting question to get asked. And then in some cases it's, you know, people, it may come from a good place. People may want to know because they may want to be, they may want to know more about it, or they may want to interact with you in a way with some depth, that if they couldn't identify you, that they may not be able to. But so I always find the question just kind of funny because if I just tell them, oh well, I'm from Boulder, you know, I'm an American, I get told, no, you're not, and that can be incredibly insulting, and it's like, do I even want to continue talking to this individual? So I always feel like that. You know, whether it's what box you check, or someone asking that question, it's to people who may be different than the majority population, it can develop into a feeling of it being a loaded question. It's like, what do you want from me? Do you want me to talk about Indian? Do you think that guy knows something about yoga that I can tell you that's helpful? why are you asking me this question? So I flip it back to that. Why do we have to identify people so much? Who is asking the question and why? So I'll leave it at that.
I would just say that this is a really interesting question with children, and I remember being like 6 and I was like, I had this conversation with my parents where I was like, so you people are telling me I'm not brown and I'm not white, which are already really weird terms, but we speak in terms of color when we're children, or also if we're just in America. And I was like, so I'm beige, right? Like, this is the answer. Like, I'm khaki, right? This is what you should tell people. And I think you go through a lot of terminology to try to figure out what to explain. And we've always had intermarriage, right? Like, my grandparents on the Israeli end, like, one of them was Israeli, but her family was German, and my other grandparent came from what is now Ukraine, but the borders kept shifting, so who knows what it was then. And they must have not had the exact same culture, but they were Jewish, so they were like, okay, this is fine, we're all Jewish. And then on my Indian grandmother and grandfather's end, they didn't speak the same language because they were from two different parts of what is now Pakistan, and then they were displaced, and because they were really effectively colonized, they spoke English to one another, and were proud of that, and were proud of going to their really Anglo schools. That meant that they lost a lot of their tradition. It's very hard for me to try to recoup that because it's so far away at this point. It's like 4 generations back, and that generation is not alive. And they, also, again, are speaking in a language that is not the language they originally spoke at home because they're from 2 different places. But we don't, again, I don't think that they dealt with this question of, like, mixed race in the same way that we have that conversation in America. And again, you can say that's because of maybe, the gulf between different countries. It can be because of the way that we talk about white and non-white. But I think, I think we're still struggling to have that conversation in the U.S.
Thank you. And there was a statement by the student through the app. I believe it was in response to the question of how do you respond to what are you? And this student wrote, I've used the term racially slash ethnically fluid in addition to my sexual and gender fluidity. So that was a response from the audience. So, Catalina, you made mention of the DNA test, or it was actually the first question on postcard that was brought up here. Asked, comment please on DNA analysis of our past. So our, I think technically they're referred to as ancestry DNA. So like ancestry.com, 23andMe. And this person would like to know pros, cons, and implications of those tests and using those tests.
Well, I'm not an expert.
And this question isn't just for you, for any of you. So, yeah.
But I did a bit of research before I went into ancestry.com and do that. But I've read that it has changed some people's lives, but mostly it has changed it in the sense that they have found out dirty secrets in their families and stuff like that. In my case, I was just almost 100% sure that I did have indigenous past, and I just wanted some sort of assurance because I can't talk about that in my family. As you just heard, my dad was like, no. And my mom is like, yeah, but who knows? And you can't go farther than that. I'd say that it's a good exercise. It would probably open your mind. The money is worth it. I don't think they're all accurate, though, so you definitely have to do your research. And now they are finding that before, like, they would take both lines, mom and dad's lines, but they are finding out that it's more like through the mom's side that some genes are passed. So I'm tempted to take it again and ask my mom to take it. And I would like my dad to take it in order to definitely complete the whole thing. So it's like a homework, really. Yeah, and you have to invest time, a bit of research. But I think it's worth it. Because even if you don't come from anywhere in the Americas, you just came from all across the ocean, it would open your mind just to find out, like Maya said, some of my family came from the Ukraine, others from Germany. And there are families that do tell those stories. My family... So you can only go back 80 years, and that's about it. So it helped me find what happened before these past 80 years. Now I cannot complete it unless I go home and, you know, I don't know, ask every member of my family, but they are very closed on that. You know, they don't want to talk about that topic. Everybody wants to be white, so... But I would say it is a good homework. And if you have the money invested, do your research so you make sure that you're getting something that is fairly good. But I can't say that they got it already. Every time, like every year, there's something that said, oh, there's a new change on DNA and there's more accuracy here and there. So, no.
Any other comments? Okay. I'm going to pull together a couple of questions about implicit bias. So one question is, do all racial and ethnic groups have implicit bias? And in countries that do not have a history of white colonialism and white Christian evangelism, are there biases based on skin color? So the first question was a closed question, yes or no. Something in between, but whatever, it depends. Do all racial or ethnic groups have implicit bias? And in countries that do not have a history of white colonialism and white Christian evangelism, are there biases based on skin color?
I'm trying to think of countries that don't have that.
Yeah,
history.
I'm trying to think about that.
I mean, I would say that's, you know, one of the gifts of colonialism is teaching these kinds of ways of, you know, using these as a way of dividing people. It's, you know, you look in, it's been done in India, or you look at the, you know, what a lot of what people see as the caste system in Indian culture is actually something, was not used in the way that, in the negative connotation it has now, really until the British colonized India and implemented their own class system that they have in the UK, and just took the caste system in India and then applied those kinds of negative separations to it. I'm just thinking to, you know, my mom, when she came to this country, and she's 18, and she grew up in Indonesia, she went to school in Chicago and Minnesota, and the main thing she tells me is, like, growing up, I couldn't complain about how cold it was, because she's like, well, you haven't been to Minnesota, so you don't know. She came from a tropical climate to that, so it's kind of a shock, but she got to see that racism as we have it in the U.S., it kind of doesn't exist outside of the U.S. Like, we it's something unique to this country. Now, we have discrimination and like I said, those colonial ties in places that may manifest, but the way it happens in this country is something unique, because she came into it from a totally outside perspective, and she, when she was studying, she stayed with the host family was a black family in Chicago, and she also eventually got a degree in education and then taught in the Chicago school system back in the 70s, and so was just shocked at what was happening. I mean, she had a host family that was black, and then she got a call one day on the phone from some, you know, wealthy donor at the college, or somebody who's some bigwig at the college, and just all they asked was, do you stay with that black family? And my mom, an Indian from Indonesia, was like, yes, and basically told my mom that she needed to not stay with that family and find a new host family if she wanted to keep a scholarship to go to school. And, you know, my mom then told me all this stuff when I was really young. I mean, the tales she told when she was in the school system in Chicago, it was like she would go and she had predominantly black students and a mix of black and white students in her class. And she was teaching one of the young kids something and went and you know, held a pencil to show them how to do the assignment. And the two other white teachers in the school came running over, you know, grabbing my mom and saying, oh, no, they gave her a tissue and said, you're not supposed to touch that black student's pencil without using a tissue. So it was bad. And so I can just imagine that my mom, coming from a culture in which this kind of thing didn't exist, got to see it from this outside point of view. And again, it's also something that just, I think, I don't know if it's a discomfort or not knowing how to talk about it, but like little stories like that I got in my life tell me a little bit about how my mom came to know about this stuff in this country, but also, you know, gave me some perspective into it as well. So I'm thinking, so the question is about biases and if these exist. I mean, I guess the lesson that I got is around how uniquely that manifests in the U.S. And I don't know that I can't, I'm having difficulty thinking of a country that wasn't colonized, that someone didn't, you know, implement a class system and label people, you know, Hutu and what Tutsi, and just do the divide and conquer thing. So if, I don't know. If anyone in the audience knows, send it up in the app and then we can come back to it.
Probably the Netherlands or Denmark, something like that maybe. I don't know. But they still have migration since the beginning of time, the Vikings. So, yeah. I would say that, don't judge me for this, but I do think that every, if we call it race, if you want to call it that, every race is biased. Yes. And the bias comes from the stories that have been told in their own families, differentiating to others, or because media told them that, or because, I don't know, a church, someone told them that, or because they haven't seen that many people, and the moment they saw someone that was different, saw them doing something that was very awkward and strange, and they immediately judged it. But yeah, I mean, I think so. I don't think that anybody does it consciously, like, oh, I'm gonna be biased, yeah, it's good. No, I mean, we just, those things were told at home, and so you just carry them outside, and you won't change it until you meet someone that helps you understand that is that thing that you assume for so many years is not correct. But I would say, in my experience, yes. And in Latin America, there's a lot of racism. We do see color. Perhaps it's not we're not as sensitive as you guys are here. We make jokes all the time, but they are insulting jokes.
I would just agree. I think that, but it's kind of more basic. It's not only about race or ethnicity, just things that are not familiar to you and are not your own experience or experience of community, are you going to be different, right? And whether that means that some of your reactions are going to think that things you see are lesser than what you do or have, and some things you're going to see and you're going to be like, wow, that's amazing, or you're going to fall in love with that, and like you can have many sorts of reactions to something that is very different from you, but I think that inevitably you're going to recognize that it's not your own, and with that comes different sorts of bias and different sorts of discrimination. And I think that it's also useful, sometimes jokes are really terrible, and sometimes they're useful. I mean, I think I remember sitting at a dinner at one point, and my parents joke very openly about their relationship because it's funny. And my dad was saying something like, when I came to this country and I met all these people and I met your mother and it was all this new frontier. And my mother said, what did you call me? Like, did you just call me the new frontier? Like, and it was, but she said it in a joking way because they'd already lived together for 25 years and so you can joke about it. But you can understand that that is a joke that is complicated and that, like, yeah, they are going to fight a lot about issues of culture and what they think is better about their own cultures.
Okay, thank you. There are two questions that are fairly similar. I'm going to go ahead and read both of them. It's with regard to educators. So one specifically references elementary teachers, and the other one, it does say children in here. So I would assume preschool through high school. One of them is, how can elementary teachers navigate teaching reading in English, or teaching and reading? How can elementary teachers navigate teaching reading in English while trying to support their diverse, so culturally, linguistically, racially, students' identity development? The other, how can educators working with diverse, multiracial students create more inclusive learning environments, especially white teachers working with young, multilingual, and multiracial children?
Well, I work with in elementary schools. That's where they hire me, and I go to perform and tell stories. And I know that teachers are trying to include more of that, and I see in their libraries, I see stories about migration, stories in other languages, their books, literally in English or in Mandarin, and they're there for the kids that come from on a specific culture. But I would say that they do need more and more support of the system. And this sounds like an advertisement, but I think that they need to bring more people. And in my case, to bring more performers or storytellers that do have that focus on multicultural, that bring that other language. It's nice, and most of the storytellers that I know, friends of mine, they have tried so hard to bring stories from all around the world, but of course the fact that they don't speak another language, that's as far as they can go, right? But when you bring another language into the story, and that's the limitation that a lot of teachers would have. They only speak English. They're not going to improvise trying to read in Mandarin or in Spanish. And they don't have the time to learn it either. And I don't blame them. They have a big, big job. But if they bring other people with those backgrounds that can throw some words in another language, that already gives the kids the idea that the world is not only English spoken, the world has other sounds and other people, and that's a good entrance. And from there, the kids normally take it, they start making their own decisions. I know they are doing it, and people like me, we're trying to put our stuff out there for free. I mean, I have a YouTube channel trying to put the stories for free. My podcast is free. So the teachers can draw from there and hand it to the kids. But of course, not everything is free. But I know that artists and storytellers and many people are trying to help with that. And there's a lot of resources in the internet.
Just a quick comment on that is I think what can also be helpful is if it isn't just up to individual teachers to do it. If you have, it can come from the community, it can come from people who have kids in those classes, in those schools, but people in the majority population to advocate for more bilingual, bicultural education in the schools and to see the value of their own kids getting that as well. And so if you advocate strongly, you can have more systemic change, and it isn't just up to individual teachers to struggle with that, and depending on who might be in the classes.
If I may say one last thing, for instance, in Texas, when a child, there's a lot of schools that are becoming dual language programs. Most of them are Spanish and English, but I found some are in Mandarin too. And that blew my mind. That's so cool. I know they are trying. Yeah, they still have a lot of ways to go, but trying.
There was a comment made on the app about the previous question. The countries that have never been colonized are Japan, Bhutan, Nepal, and Ethiopia. And if I could just make a comment as a sociologist, one of the issues, though, even for some of those countries that haven't been colonized by European whites, is that there's still that, as Carolina mentioned a while back, around the more white you look, the more benefits you get. And so sometimes in many of these countries, even if they haven't been colonized, we'll still see where there is, for some Asian individuals, where they may be doing plastic surgery to change the shape of their eyes, or using skin lightening products to lighten their skin closer to white, right? So even if they haven't, it's kind of this global effect, which I believe is what some of you were saying.
That's colonialism too. Media has a huge effect on that. I mean, even if you haven't seen a single white person around you and everybody looks like you, the moment you turn a TV show, American show, and you see all those happy white people successful in New York and all that, you want to be like them.
Okay, so another question. This person says that they have a grandson who is half Sweden, half Pierce? Get the pronunciation. So indigenous. And is blonde and blue-eyed, was rejected by the Nez Perce tribe based on looking white. The question is, how would someone deal with looking white but who identifies as native or indigenous?
Can I tell a short story? 1 minute. Well, in my research, I found out that there's a story that is told in Central America. I'm not going to say where exactly, and also in South America. And it's exactly the same story, and it's technically an indigenous story, but I really don't think so. And it says, they say that when God was making the people, it's like making cookies, right? And so they mold it, and then they put it in the oven. And at the beginning, he didn't cook them well enough, and so that's why they were white, right? And so he realized a mistake, and he had to cook them more, and he put them again, but he overcooked them, and that's why the second batch was black. And then he finally figured it out, the exact time, he put them, and then they were brown. But the indigenous people will claim they were indigenous. They won't call it brown. It's indigenous. And it kind of sounds like a little bit of like a racist to me, but that's the way they were able to understand all these new people that were coming to their lands, whites and these blacks. So what's going on? And yes, I mean, that's kind of like my response to the question that I already forgot.
But for individuals who are white passing, it was specifically about indigenous persons, but for individuals who are white passing, but part of their identity is of a person of color.
Okay, yeah, this is just to say that even indigenous people, due to the oppression that they have been through, they also have become biased. And if it is hard for them to accept others that have been born outside their own cluster. And that's why when I say that every race is biased, it's because, I mean, I've seen it and I read about it. And so it is a big struggle. And I know there's a lot of people that struggle with that because they just were born more white or more another color. And that is always, it is a struggle, and I don't have an answer for that. Good luck. But keep believing in who you are.
I also think that sometimes people find like a tradition where they are not expecting it to, like might not be their own tradition, and might find other communities that are willing to explore like that Indigenous identity, but maybe from a slightly different perspective, and that it really depends on finding communities that are willing to give you the language to talk about these issues, that are willing to have debates about it, that are willing to teach different languages, that are willing to have, like, you know, whether it is like some preservation of cultural tradition or some sort of performance that means that, like, children are just opened up to a lot of different things, that you don't have to necessarily turn towards the people closest to you and say, like, will you accept me?
I think it can, outside of just skin color, especially I think with second generation immigrants and people who may not have as much of a connection, it may have been difficult to try to establish a connection with the culture they come, that the family's traditions lie in. You know, you could face this challenge. Like when I was growing up, if I visited India with my family, the Indians didn't see me as Indian. It was like, this guy's from Colorado. Somehow, you know, in both Indonesia and India, they all knew about John Elway. I don't know, and they would always ask me about that. You know, you're not one of us in Indonesia. You're not one of us in India. And then you come to Boulder, and it's like, will you flum? And it's like, I'm from Boulder. And it's like, no, you're not American. You know, so you... It can be difficult because you wind up in the situation you just don't, you wind up not belonging to any culture. You could either feel you don't belong to any of them, you could feel even rejected by them in some ways. And so I think my only advice to that family, that kid, is to, you know, while we talk about all of these boxes and stuff you check, I would say the main thing is to know yourself as an individual and to, you know that as an individual you transcend those labels on you. You know, you may want to embrace them. You know, you may have different levels of luck in doing that. But I think at the end, it always comes down to you knowing yourself as an individual. Because as you go on in life, you'll be in situations where those labels don't. They don't mean as much. You'll be in contexts in which they just don't they don't have as much value. And so really what it comes down to is getting to know you as an individual as much as you can help navigate those situations.
I just want to say one thing. One time someone told me that you find your family in the stars. It just means that sometimes you grew up within a family and they just don't seem like your family. I mean, they don't accept you for who you are, or your choices. But in life, you always will meet people like Maya, and he said that both share your own values, and then you create these new families. So.
And I also just think it's going to happen more and more inevitably. You will find more people with time who are dealing with these questions, right? So I write about immigration in Mexico. Last week, I was interviewing people in southern Mexico, and a lot of them were people from the Democratic Republic of Congo who had gone to live in Brazil or Chile and whose children were born there and who are now migrating to the U.S. And so those children already had multiple languages that they had grown up with at home. Or there is a whole wave of Haitian migration to Mexico in 2016, and many Haitians, when U.S. policy changed, ended up living in Tijuana. And there's this like very lovely man who wrote a book about what it means to walk across a large chunk of Latin America. And he went and married a Mexican woman, and they have a kid who's growing up in Tijuana. And that child also has like an incredibly rich new identity that they will have to explore growing up. And I think with every different migration trend and every... you know, every time there's like a new ability to get up and leave to another country, and the more that becomes common, that this question of how do you stay tied to your heritage but also truly reinvent yourself, because you're not going to find a lot of people who share your exact experience, is going to be more discussed, and there'll be more language for it. And I listened to this podcast on Latino USA this morning that was about Asian Latinx people, and it was like people who were Filipino, Salvadoran, or people who were Korean, raised in Argentina. And it was super interesting, right, because their experience is super different from my own. but they talked about, you know, what it means to sort of be ping-ponged between different cultures and be told you're not one and you're not the other, and yet to really enjoy eating, like, the food that comes out of that mix, to eat, like, Filipino tacos or something like that. And I thought that was really cool.
I like that.
Okay. Thank you. I am going to present two similar questions again. Sorry, it's my vision. I'm trying to get the lights here. First of all, well-meaning people in Boulder keep asking me about my ethnicity and want to learn more. All of us in Colorado are deprived of ongoing ethnically rich arts and cultural programs. How can we help see more of this in public spaces? So that's one. And the other one is connected in the sense of organizations and graduate programs, so educational organizations as well. What responses and reactions would you have to organizations, graduate programs, and other advanced skill or selective places encouraging diverse candidates to apply? So about inclusion questions in public spaces as well as organizations, including educational institutions.
Well, I think when it comes to public spaces and culture, I will say on my commission, the Human Relations Commission, we also give out funding to events. So a lot of the more visible cultural events, for instance, like, you know, the Boulder Jewish Festival. I mentioned I was involved in establishing Indigenous Peoples Day and, you know, the Martin Luther King Day events as well. And a host of them all come and apply to my commission, and we give them money, and those get put on by community groups. So I think if, you know, my thing is like, if I see something that isn't happening, I try to make it happen, you know, and that could mean if you have an idea of an event you're not seeing, you may have, you know, less limits than you think in trying to make that happen. And I think there's a lot of ways to go out and get community support and funding to make those things happen. But I will say that I don't like seeing one-off events, whether it's on campus with CU, sometimes with the city. It can feel a little bit like checking a diversity box or something like that. And what we need to get to is just for this to become the culture, for it to be baked into it and not be, you know, teased out as something that is different from the usual things you see. It needs to be in day-to-day life. And that's a challenging question, because without a capacity enough of a capacity of minority people locally, it can be difficult to see that happen. When it comes to, I think the question was about education and I think
organizations about diversification within organizations.
Yeah,
by race.
I mean, I think it has to be intentional in hiring people, but also I think it'll change when you have enough people in visible positions, people of color, that, you know, young people can look up to them and actually see someone in positions they couldn't imagine themselves in who look like them and may come from the same backgrounds as them. And that's something that we're only kind of making some headway in now a little bit. But if you don't see people who look like you, you wouldn't think I could do that. And that's just a really difficult thing to convince people of. But if they see someone who looks like them and can perhaps meet them and talk to them, that can change everything.
I may say, without a demand, there is no chance for, like, putting something together. So sometimes you just have to knock on doors and say, hey, bring this, do this. Or you just do it yourself, with your friends. And I was yesterday at a classroom here, and I met some kids that are part of the student organization. And the teacher was joking that they have so much money, their budget is really large. So there's places where the money is. It's just resting right there. They just need some people to go and say, hey, I have an idea. Let's do this. Maybe I don't know how to, but if you join forces, you will get there. Grants. I applied to a lot of grants, because what I heard all the time is that there's a lot of grants that are not given because people don't even try. So I'll try, Maybe they say no, next time I'll try it again. Because I have tons of ideas. So if you have ideas, talk with someone, and then it becomes bigger, and they knock on doors. Not everybody's going to open, but someone will open. That's for sure.
I would just say also movies are awesome. And it can be for whatever, right? There's not sort of one answer as to what needs to happen. And sometimes you see that different organizations are each working on their own project. In Mexico City last month, the three documentary series that were happening, one was from Ambulante, which is a sort of touring documentary project that brings a lot of films, mostly from Mexico and all other parts of Latin America, two different states and tours, which is an amazing project. And then someone put together like a feminist queer film festival, and someone put together a Canadian movie festival. And I was like, who thought of that there should be a Canadian festival in the middle of Mexico City? I have no idea, but someone has spent a lot of time on this, and now there's an entire 10-day series, and so I might as well go. And so I think that those projects can exist in all sorts of places, and it's sort of dependent on whoever has the bright idea that says that this needs to be seen in a certain place. And it's really fun, especially if they're outdoors when it gets not this cold.
Thank you all. So unfortunately, we only have 4 minutes left, and there have been some great questions that you all have given, both on the app and by card. And so I have to make the executive decision. We'll end on race labeling. There were several questions about the labeling of race. So one of the questions was, can you speak on the language of, quote, native versus indigenous versus aboriginal and any other similar designation? Are there particular connotations of these different word choices? So that was one of the questions. So I would say maybe end on something around labeling, race labeling, our use of language for different races, and any comments you may have to that.
Wow.
And any preferred terms based on particular communities.
I think all I have to say is that the more advanced we think our civilizations are becoming, the more we are trying to classify and dissect everything and give these specific words that every time they just, they're trying to classify. That's exactly what it is. I don't like to use big words ever because I think that there's no need for them and there's no need for to use so many labels. But if someone doesn't understand what I'm saying, well, I will explain myself. But yeah, I mean, I do struggle with using all those words because in the end you don't know necessarily know if they're appropriate for what you're trying to say at the moment. It's just words that people, scholars, have decided to use to classify and dissect even more to at a molecular place, right? I don't know. It's just trying to go to the very bottom, and I don't think it's needed.
Yeah, I think, like I said, I think we try to classify too much, and you know, I think it's worth investigating, you know, what is the intention behind that in each context. If a group of people have a specific way they would like you to, you know, something they would like you to call them, if it's indigenous as opposed to native, I just go ahead and do it. It's kind of like, but just know that that changes with time. You know, a decade ago it wasn't like that. A decade from now it's going to be something else, and you'll have to adapt and change the labels again. But I think the common theme between all three of us and what we talked about is that none of us fit neatly into a box and label. So I don't see as much value in it. I always think of that scene in The Big Lebowski when, at the beginning when he says, the assistant calls him Jeffrey, and he's like, oh, no, it's dude, his dudeness, and he just keeps... So, calm down with the labeling a little bit. And I think because we're so data-driven and we're so on social media and we always have to fill out boxes identifying us so that companies can collect marketing data. I think we need to push back on that, and maybe just in real life and day-to-day conversations with people and how we talk to people, it might be nice to let some of those labels go and just treat each other as human beings and try to see people who, how they want to be seen and how they would like to interact with you.
Yeah, I would just echo the comment that these labels are going to change, and I think it's interesting to see how they change over time, and to, I don't know, I studied literature in college, and so to look at literature from 50 years ago or 100 years ago and try to understand how to understand the terms that are being used in the context in which they were written, and try to also see what's appropriate for a given moment, but know that, that that's very fleeting. And I feel like, you know, the whole project of trying to rescue terms from history and give them a positive spin as part of social movements, or doing the opposite, sort of abandoning terms that have too difficult connotations and coming up with new ones, is a very valid one. But the language is sort of a proxy for trying to deal with larger issues, right? That, like, trying to find a better word is just a way to finding more acceptance, or a way of finding a way of reclaiming an identity that has otherwise been treated in a hostile manner. And so the issue is not the word, though that's sometimes what we're going to end up debating. It's really how are we treating one another, how are we treating ourselves, are we finding a way to speak in some cases proudly about a certain heritage, or to speak to the complexities of it, even in cases where you feel like you've lost part of your heritage, using the language at hand. And I think all of that is wrapped into the language discussions that are super important, but sometimes we treat them in isolation, as though the real issue at hand is what is the specific term we're going to use, as opposed to, you know, are we treating people fairly, or are we treating ourselves fairly?
Thank you, Maya, Catalina, and Nikhil. Thank you all.